travel. At Tim Hortons, off of 417 in a Franco, Ontario town, the flaneurs gather to bypass chagrin, nurse coffees and finger car keys, the idle way they used to flick their cigarettes. They trade anecdotes for gossip, prices for the stores, eyes fixed on outsiders revolving in and out the doors. Mistrust protects a hard-fought land, yet their gaze betrays a yearning, as if these flaneurs await an invitation from a stranger they would call itinerant. Beneath the red sign cloned in many elsewheres, they sit enclosed like the rarest flowers. By windows streaming summer winter sun, their uniqueness never celebrated in any inn à la beauté. Oh, subversive innocence. A few meters outside on the concrete wall, the sign warns, no loitering, pas de flanage. They're likely unaware of Baudelaire and dare not dream of travel this late in life. But if a vagabond would summon them, mon enfant, ma soeur, each one of these flaneurs would stand submissively, step through the doors, and follow to the poet's distant land. So this event was billed as the February Blues removal event. And I think the best way to get rid of February Blues is to skip town and go somewhere really far south. So tonight, we're taking off to Latin America. The first stop is Argentina, where right now it's summer. Here's my take on the megacity called Buenos Aires. Brazen metropolis. It thrills me still, the night-long flight down the Andean spine, until hues of dawn ignite the thread of Amazon, and the plane descends into the swarm of sleepless streets. Palacios with balcony facades corroded by the blood of history. Palo Borrachos and jacaranda trees competing in a skyward race with glitzy global tunes. I flow along the melodies, Corrientes, Suipacha, Libertador, and in the chaos of those city streets, discern the poet's legacies. Borges' promise of adventure, Storni's lines to the sadness of Buenos Aires, and Lowell, who flew home in a straitjacket 1,000 miles from nowhere. My first time here in 83, the city stirred from the six-year Derby War, like a necropolis resurrected from its marble chill. By Recoleta's vaults and mausoleums, the kneeling congregation sang, Oh, save us. Inside Pilar Church, the walls of ochre white, built by their hands, responded with the silence of denial. When, forgive me, I was naive and bold, I asked about the outlines of bodies spray-painted on sidewalks in the night, and the women with white headscarves who circled the Plaza de Mayo Thursday afternoons. I was told, de eso no se habla. 30,000 disappeared. Of this, one does not speak. The junta's scars still fester. The infections never treated. The congenital malignancy in the sniffed out eyes of a kid on Libertador. If his hands can't deliver enough wallets to the strong man on the block, this beaver will sleep hungry on his cardboard square beneath the portal to check out the cemetery that Borges called a slum for souls. And yet, the miracle of murals in the alleys, poetry in plazas, the bandoneon in bars, milongas reinvented, amplified, the edgy wonder, the flash, the jokes, the time to linger and debate, the city's recent bauble, a 66-foot flower of steel with solar-powered petals that close at dusk, an evening reverence, folding into itself in prayer. Nights are brash in Buenos Aires, with the glint and glitter of a sprawling grid laid out like sabers, swords, and daggers. Amid the defiant razzle-dazzle, popping corks, the swish of silk, I hear despair in the rattling wheels of makeshift carts as cartoneros in the thousands scavenge through the trash. So this next poem also touches on obliviousness. It was inspired by La Cienega, a film by Lucrecia Martel, who's a member of the New Argentine Cinema Movement. It's called The Swamp in San Lorenzo. Four sisters and their school friends, splayed in deck chairs by a pool of turquoise and decay, swap stories. Did he really? And conspire, I swear he did, by the sunken reservoir, inlaid with azure tiles, chipped and fading now. The girls perspire, get high on fumes of purple, lime green, coral rose, painting their toes outside the villa built by stepfather's great-grandmother, first cousin to General Perón. They never pause to think of him, to notice shadows cast by tipa trees across neglected grass, still spongy from the Christmas rains. In the nearby city, they play piano, singing choirs, memorize the epic poetry. Aquí me pongo a cantar como la ave solitaria, of the gaucho who consoles himself with song, like the solitary songbird. This month of holidays, spent swampside in the hills of San Lorenzo, the girls turned a deeper shade, amber to mahogany, except the youngest with red hair, who pouts because her freckles only multiply. Near dusk, four sisters and their school friends plunge into the collar of turquoise decadence, float, limbs splayed. Their rippling strands of hair entrap chicada corpses, while in the deep, a rusty drain is clogged by tipa flowers, the laurels of a decomposing oven bird called hornero here, a tiny pit left by its missing eyeball. So it's a real honor for me to be reading here tonight. Over the years, I've witnessed some of the finest poets reading at the Atwater Poetry Project. Last month, for example, I was blown away by Mark Di Saverio's reading. Not only did he share his fine poems, but he read a few works by other poets, such as Rambo, Ezra Pound, and Melody. In that vein, I'd like to read a poem by a groundbreaking poet who nobody's ever heard of, I would imagine. Her name is Delmira Agustin, and she was born in Montevideo. She was the first woman to write erotic poetry in Spanish. During her short life, she published three collections of poems which caught the attention of the likes of Rubén Darío. In 1914, when she was 27, she was shot dead by her ex-husband in a murder-suicide. Here's her sonnet entitled The Encounter, followed by a glossa I wrote after Agustín's poem, in which I imagine what she would tell her fellow poets today. La Cita, The Encounter, by Delmira Agustín. In your chamber covered with reverie, make waste of flowers and of spiritual lights. My soul, shod in silence and dressed in calm, will go after you down the darkest path of this night. Turn out the lights and behold things beautiful. Close all doors and enter illusion. Uproot from mystery a handful of stars and cover with flowers like a triumphal vase, your heart. And you will wait smiling, and you will wait weeping. When my soul arrives, perhaps you will pray, thinking that heaven sweetly spills over your chest. For divine love, sit upon a sofa of calm, or with the mystical lily that is its sword, my soul will make vanish one by one the roses of your bed. Manifesto of a Murdered Poet. Poets, sisters of the spoken word, craft your postings well. Embrace all vagary. Take courage as daily you sit down to write. Dig deep and then dig deeper. Stare down the blackest stain. Neither slam your laptop nor abandon words. Repeat, repeat until you are depleted. Then begin anew to wrestle time and space. In your chamber covered with reverie, make waste of pressure and rejection, advice and coping tips. Waltz naked with your demons. Make music to your nervous tics. Prepare to be misunderstood and marginalized, condemned, lamented, eulogized. Take on your time with all its complications. Unearth the essence and subvert adornments. Lyrics full of flowers and of spiritual lights. My soul will guide you into galaxies, past intrigue, critics, and the con men. Expect no solace from the stars. Once, in my anguished loneliness, I confessed insanity to Ruben Darío. His response? To live is the obligation of happiness. Nonsense. Wear your isolation like a badge. Bask in the halo of melancholy. Your body strong, shod in silence, and dressed in calm. Torment your soul with authenticities. Be clever with your prophecies. Inoculate yourself from fear. Love in multiples and deeply. But take care with how you die. Leave no trace for misinterpretation. Shred all drafts, deletions, doodles, as every ink stain you've created, digitized or reproduced in black and white, will go after you down the darkest path of this night. These next poems are set in the Andes. Both refer to the quena, which is an ancient instrument played by the Incas, essentially a single flute made of either bamboo or cane. It has an agile sound. It's kind of like the wind of the Cordillera or the Andes. My beloved, who grew up in Argentina, plays the quena, as do many musicians in Peru, Bolivia, and Chile. Cordillera Midnight. In the unseen stillness of your vertigo, a quena quivers. The southern constellation flickers hope from star to star. The quena testifies. The cadence of the Urubamba, the yellow trills of siskin birds, the howl of winds that sweep the peaks, the thunder of the sliding rocks, the gliding beat of condor wings, the llamas skittering across the ridge, the threshers in the copra fields, the drench of rain that ricochets, the dance of maize and terraces, the carnivals of tumbling joy, the purple sway of orchids, the fragile fluttering of ferns, the gasp of air so thin, the knowing glint of sunrise, the thirst of weaponry, the blood-red clay of cliffs, the rumble of the quaking earth, the curse of occupation, the echoes of the fallen stars, the indifference of the heavens, the ruins of the civilized, the vertigo of homelessness, the flickering eyes have disappeared, the urgent cries of Nunca Mas. All this, the quena testifies. We're moving on to Chile now. Here's a poem about the mining accident a few years ago when 33 miners were trapped underground for 69 days after their mine came down. Then I'll segue back to North America via time Tommy won't keep up. Buried alive. His rebirth is dangerous. Deep in the Atacama copper mine, Omar perspires and prays. His family holds vigils in Campamento Esperanza, while three teams drill down a deep, dark hole. The media are thrilled to cover Operación San Lorenzo, and the patron saint of miners delivers on day 69. Omar Regadas ascends in rescue capsule Phoenix Dos. Wearing Oakley radar sunglasses, rescued miner 17 steps into his son's embrace, baptized again into Chilean light. He blesses his newborn grandchild, submits to dental work, and is interviewed by BBC. I'm a changed man, Omar says. Born again, but I'll go back into the mine. I am a mole. Miscarriage. What if the other Omar, our Omar, we could say, lost an eye in battle and was captured at age 15 and is trapped behind the wire? To protect his shrapnel-damaged other eye from the glare of Cuban sun, Ottawa sends sunglasses for this Canadian son, not worth the rescue. What if his name was Stephen? Omar means eloquent and long-lived, which means he'll speak one day, maybe sign a book deal. But why, if not forgiven, would he forgive? An eye for an eye, Omar Khadr. I should say that after I wrote that poem, Omar Khadr was repatriated to Canada, and he remains in prison in Alberta. He's now 28, and he's been trying to study his high school diploma. But his one functioning eye is going blind and he needs medical treatment. Of his bail hearing set for this March 24th, the current regime in Ottawa says it's doing, quote, everything in its power to make sure Khadr stays in prison. So, now to more cheerful subjects. We're moving back to North America. My book, Scientists of Pursuit Innocence, is structured around a quartet of poems set in an abandoned marble quarry. I'm going to read the first of the quartet. Quarry one. We've often passed this masterpiece, carved with ice age grace, into the roadside woods. This time, he indulges me. We leave the car, walk single file towards the water's edge. I strain to discern our reflections on a looking glass flecked by shedding birch trees, October leaves floating in clusters within the marble's craggy ledges. While so intensely visual, the first effect is audible, as screams and laughter echoed from a season ago when beach towels draped the boulders and swimmers cooled off until dusk. Some kissed, shared a joint, and shivered at the glimpse of starbursts atop the surface of the pond, tiny halos of refracted light on the rippling dark blackness. And later, in the moonlight, they fumbled with buttons and zippers, then scrambled up a ledge to mark the marble, Evan Hart Hanna, 1997. More pledge than defacement, the way a scar makes beauty interesting. But how do we ponder? Is this the place to chisel your love? Before reading my last poem, I'd like to thank all of you for coming tonight. I'd like to also thank Atwater Library and the Atwater Portrait Project for having me. It's been a huge honor to meet after Dave Foreman and his very inventive poetry. Here's a subversive love song that I'd like to dedicate to my beloved, who's in Argentina right now. Miraculous montage of the morning mind. Let me tell you what I love most about being alive. No, it's not. 6:05, when the music plays and thrashing into stolen slumber, I reconfigure skunky morning smells, blissful as a kleptomaniac. How shallow, as in lacking depth of knowledge or thought, like a skunk waddling into focus beneath elm trees at dawn, an urban refugee displaced, found dead or elsewhere. She feasts on the discarded crumbs of someone's grainy muffin, scavenging things as they come, improvised and self-sufficient. The simulation of filmy frames transformed by silver nitrate, or blacks the putrescent banana, whites the curving onion peel, and morality's in the garbage can anyway, while sins be tipping it over. To forage with greedy paws, your trash is her treasure. Viewed through a voyeur's mirror in a rapid sequence of juxtaposing reflections, which requires me to race with shallow breath, capture all those images like a scene shot by Eisenstein, trickster lens panning to and from the cherubs and the lions, except I focus on the swizzling sprinkler, silvering striated leaves on long earthbound bows, the skunks in lightened water down the swank of an elm street. And what I love second most, still not you, is the velocity of mind, distance divided by time, equaling the flash with which the skunks displaced by me making love in the shallows of the lake with you, finally. So alive to the contrast, heat in the wetness of cold, the dawn's glow slicing through elms. This miraculous montage, infinitely flashing, agile, and beyond rank, like you, captures the kaleidoscopes of our splashy rainbow arc, the yin-yang of our arching backs, and serenades our wake-up song.
Get involved in Montreal's poetry community.
because poetry is so important. Poetry is important for a plethora of incredible philosophical, strange, artistic reasons, but most of all, it's important because of the look I saw in that 8-year-old's eye when she was proud that she'd written the thing that meant something that was her feelings. So thank you all for coming. I hope you come back and enjoy yourself.